But we're used to it.
House Committee on Energy and Environment will come to order. Lots on the agenda today, colleagues, but hopefully relatively straightforward. Say at the beginning, Senate Bill 692B, we're still waiting on the fiscal impact on that. We expect to have it by the end of this meeting, so we're going to just push that down the list a little bit. And so I'm going to start by opening a work session on Senate Bill 605A. Colleagues, you'll remember this is the bill we heard testimony on relating to the relating to OPAC, and we have a dash 5 amendment that we heard about in the last committee hearing. To my knowledge, nothing has changed since the last committee hearing, and we're ready to go.
Is the right one here?
Yep.
Mr. Chair, I move to adopt the dash 5 amendments dated May 9th of 2013.
Vice Chair Johnson moves to adopt the dash 5 amendments dated May 9th, 2013. Is there a discussion? Is there objection to the dash 5s? Seeing none, dash 5s are adopted. Vice Chair Johnson.
Mr. Chair, I move to adopt Senate Bill 605A as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Vice Chair Johnson moves Senate Bill 605A as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there a discussion? Seeing none, clerk, please call the roll.
Representative Bibbs.
Aye.
Representative Dembro.
Aye.
Representative Reardon.
Aye.
Representative A. Peterson.
Aye.
Representative Widener.
Excused.
Representative Whitsitt.
Aye.
Vice Chair Johnson.
Aye.
Vice Chair Boone.
Aye.
Chair Bailey.
Aye. Motion carries. And Representative Boone, would you like to carry this one?
I would, thank you.
All right. Representative Boone will carry. Close the work session on Senate Bill 605A. And open a work session on Senate Bill 606A. Vice Chair Johnson?
Chair Bailey, I move Senate Bill 606A to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Vice Chair Johnson moves Senate Bill 606A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion.
It'd be a field trip. Does she have any light on this topic?
Changed my mind.
It did, actually. As a matter of fact, this bill did come up on our field trip. For those, for our vast listening audience at home, this committee attended a wave energy facility in its Tuesday hearing and had a very interesting time with the Oregon Wave Energy Trust and heard from the industry about their desire to be good stewards and to remove items that are left behind or anchored to the bottom and to make sure that they're cleaning up after themselves. The pick up your toys bill.
Yes.
All right, see no further discussion.
Not what?
What? Oh, sorry. Clerk, please call the roll.
Representative Benz.
Aye.
Representative Dembro.
Aye.
Representative Reardon.
Aye.
Representative Meg Peterson.
Aye.
Representative Widener.
Which number? We're on Senate Bill 606, Representative.
Yes.
It's a good one.
Yes. Aye.
Representative Whitsitt?
Aye.
Vice Chair Johnson?
Aye.
Vice Chair Boone?
Aye.
Chair
Bailey? I don't know where that came from. Aye. It's been a long day. Sorry.
That was some field trip, Mr. Chair.
That was some field trip.
Still overwhelmed.
Sorry, Representative Vice Chair Boone. All right. Motion carries. Bill is sent to the floor.
I move to carry it.
Representative Reardon will carry. With that, close the work session on Senate Bill 606A. Do you want to make a motion?
Yeah. Chair Bailey, I move that we suspend the rules and allow Representative Widener to cast a vote on Senate Bill 605A.
Do I need to open a work session?
Correct.
Okay, I need to open a work session. I'm going to open a work session on 605A. Let me say that again.
Chair Bailey, I
sorry.
Move that we suspend rules and allow Representative Widener to cast his vote on Senate Bill 605A.
Vice Chair Johnson moves the rules be suspended in order to allow Representative Widener to cast a vote on Senate Bill 605A. Seeing no objection, so ordered. Representative Widener, how do you vote?
Aye.
Representative Widener votes aye. Close the work session on Senate Bill 605A. Open a work session on Senate Bill 230A.
Chair Bailey, I move Senate Bill 230A to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Vice Chair Johnson moves Senate Bill 230A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion? Is there? Seeing none, clerk, please call the roll.
Representative Benz.
Aye.
Representative Dembro.
Aye.
Representative Burden.
Aye.
Representative Baker Peterson.
Aye.
Representative Widener.
Aye.
Representative Whitsitt.
Aye.
Vice Chair Johnson.
Aye.
Vice Chair Boone.
Aye.
Chair Bailey.
Aye. Motion carries. Colleagues, might this be something for the consent calendar? 2:30?
If you want no votes.
Okay, I don't want no votes. Then we will not put on the consent calendar. I just thought it'd be fun to try.
Well, I guess there are some people that get offended by things going to the consent calendar without any explanation or if they have a question.
Got it.
So,
Representative Widener, would you like to carry the bill?
That's fine.
All right, sounds good. Representative Widener, I'll carry. Close the work session on Senate Bill 230A. And open a work session on Senate Bill 840. And call up Mark Long, please. Well, he's coming up. Adam, you want to remind us on Senate Bill 840? Just give us the quick overview.
Chair Bailey, members of the committee, House Bill 840 is dealing with water conservation efforts, specifically related to water closets, faucets, lavatories, urinals, things of that nature.
Good afternoon, Chair Bailey, members of the committee. Mark Long, Administrator of State Building Codes. Want to give you some information regarding plumbing code and plumbing products. Just to remind the committee, we're the organization that adopts all of the codes for construction, which includes plumbing, but also electrical, structural, mechanical, boiler, elevator, et cetera. When we adopt codes in the state, they are statewide. The standards that we regulate are carried out in 130 city and county jurisdictions around the state, and that becomes the standard. It is both the minimum and the maximum standard in Oregon. The codes that we adopt, and specific to plumbing, because that's what Senate Bill 840 is about, include not only how to install the products, but also what products you can use from a contractor standpoint, and then what the inspector looks at or regulates under our regulatory tent. We adopt codes about every 3 years. We use a national code that, just show you, this is the IAPMO code. It comes from a national organization. They publish a document about every 3 years, and this has lots of input at the national level that includes organizations such as the contractor, various contractor groups, labor groups, sanitary sewer providers, a bunch of different folks who participate in development of this document that we review. We're getting ready to review the 2014 code. It's actually the 2012 Uniform Plumbing Code. It'll be the 2014 Oregon Code. And why I'm here is there are some areas in current law, if you look at Senate Bill 840, it amends ORS 447-145. And under current law, there are plumbing fixture standards that were adopted in 1991 through statute. I don't know why that was done in 1991. Currently, that's all done through this code process. It's been that way since I've been running building codes and as long as I can remember for a long, long time. The reason why I'm here is there will be some conflicts, not in this book that we currently have, but in the next model code that are coming down from IAPMO with the existing statute that I'll need your help as members modifying to align with the work that's already occurred from the various interest groups that look at these matters technically at the national level. Then they come to Oregon. We go through an exhaustive process through the plumbing board. Lots of folks look at it, and then we ultimately adopt it. It comes, and we train the contractors, and then we train the inspectors, and then it's forced throughout the state, and then we start that process all over again. As far as the specific provisions of Senate Bill 840, I think the committee's heard concern from a variety of folks. Our interest in this was simply to make sure it was aligned in the correct statutory area and that our contractors, inspectors, and the manufacturers we work with were supportive. I'm not sure what the chair's pleasure on the bill itself, but I wanted to talk to you that we're going to need something at the Building Codes Division because in the next version coming down the pike, there's going to be some differences between the faucet standards that are in current law and what's been agreed upon through not exactly this document, the next version of this document, through the folks throughout the process, and I'll be back asking for that relief. Questions?
Appreciate the update, Mr. Long, and I think in summary, it's am I right in that it's fair to say there are concepts within this bill that continue to be worth discussion. There are specific provisions within this bill that will probably need to be changed going forward, but in the meantime, there are efforts you can take as we continue to figure out the complexities of this bill, and most likely we'll have the subject back before us in a future session.
You will, Mr. Chair. I'll be coming back to kind of align what occurs nationally and gets all worked out, and it's not everything that was proposed in this bill as far as getting the plumbing product standards aligned with the current code. You want to do that because this is a document that's used by a lot of states and a lot of jurisdictions around. It's the one that the contractors, again, their names right on here, as well as the installers and a variety of the groups. It's what they use, and we wouldn't want to be in conflict with that. And because we put these standards in 1991 into the statute, which, again, we don't do that in my world. It's done through the boards and it's done administratively working off of these codes. I'm going to need to fix that.
Excellent. Appreciate that heads up and appreciate your work on this. Any questions for Mr. Long? Okay. Thank you. Oh, sorry, Representative Widener.
Just going through, I'm just looking at some of the stuff that's in the bill here, going from like on a flush 1.6 gallons to 1.3.
Right.
There's someone who just built an energy efficient house, and I have one toilet that is at the one, actually I think it's a gallon and a half, and then another one that is a little less, or the efficient toilet, so I could get certification. We find that you're flushing that toilet a couple times rather than one time, so I'm wondering if we're getting a little tight on some of these requirements for the flush for a toilet and things like that. And I've noticed it actually in some of the toilets here at the Capitol need to be flushed a couple times as well.
Chair Bailey, Representative Widener, could be, just so you know, for this document, which is 2009, which is the current plumbing code, it's at 1.6, which is in the standard here in the statute that you see. The 2012 version of this document is 1.6 for the toilet. The discussion so far for 2015, and this is completely out there, we would probably adopt around 2018 or 2019, so way out there, is 1.28, but I don't know what the technology will be by then. Okay, this bill would have moved it at 1.3. I'm here to tell you what the code folks do that I work with through my process, and this group, who I feel very comfortable that they kind of review all these issues because it has the manufacturers on there, the contractors, the sanitary sewer engineers, just I can go into the back cover and just kind of rattle off all the different interest groups that participate. I feel pretty comfortable by the time this is vetted nationally, and then when it comes to Oregon, it goes through the plumbing board, and then all the experts we get here, technically, and then by the time it gets to my desk, that we're pretty well vetted as far as what the right types of products are and what the right code standards are. But I probably didn't answer your question specifically. That's just kind of my view on how the system works currently. And the reason why I came here is, although through Senate Bill 840 and kind of originally with 692, it was going to continue to modify these provisions in statute, I'd like to talk to you at either the next session or the session after that about maybe looking at putting these things back into the code making process and letting the folks that do this kind of full-time ferret these issues out, because I feel pretty comfortable with the process. Hope I answered your question.
It's a good suggestion, and I want to just frame for the committee on this particular bill, it's not our intention to work this bill this session, so we're just getting some context from Mr. Long for future discussion, so it's not our intention to move forward with this particular bill.
That's my concern.
Yep. Okay, seeing no further questions, thank you, Mr. Long. Look forward to continued discussions on this. Close the work session on Senate Bill 840. Open a public hearing on Senate Bill 561. Adam?
Chair Bailey, members of the committee, Senate Bill 561A allows the Public Utility Commission to authorize a public utility to set a tariff schedule that provides energy resource measures to individual property owners or customers, requires PUC approval for tariff schedules, and provides examples of energy resource measures.
Call up Gary Bauer and Jeff Bissonnette. Somewhat appropriate, colleagues, that we are ending our committee with this bill. In terms of the number of days, on a subject that's similar to the one that we began it with.
Thank you, Chair Bailey, members of the committee. I'm Gary Bauer with Northwest Natural. Senate Bill 561 is the result of a conversation that the governor's office had with us prior to the session, looking for us to identify some opportunities to move energy efficiency and some renewables forward. We actually had a couple of ideas. One, which was in the bill, was taken out on the Senate side. It had a little bit controversial. But basically, this is a cleanup of a statute that's been on the books for about 20 years, I believe, and has not been used to speak of. But it would allow a utility to enter into a contract with a customer to perform energy efficiency measures, renewables, whatever the customer thinks they need. And for example, on a commercial side, we occasionally get questions from large campus types of operations where they're looking to make a number of changes or looking for any kind of opportunity they can. This would allow us to work directly with them, enter into a contract, and then if necessary, we could work through some financing types of operations, or they can do all that with somebody else that just pay it back over time on the bill. Kind of a takeoff from the EAST program that Chair Bailey introduced to us a few years ago. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Bissonnette.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Jeff Bissonnette with the City Utility Board of Oregon. We have been on record sort of guarded against the second part of the bill that had been taken out that provided the opportunity for having utilities make a rate of return on energy efficiency, and that was something that we thought would unnecessarily drive up energy efficiency programs and costs, but that has been taken out. We just want to be on the record that with that, we were neutral on the bill.
Thank you. Questions? Representative Whitsitt.
Just so I understand, when this is done and the home is sold to a new homeowner, is it what you would consider the equivalent of a lien that would be on the home that they are required to pay back to the utility then for the...
Chair Bailey, Representative Whitsitt. When we looked at this, we were really looking more on the commercial industrial side. There is a program known as EAST that is currently available for homeowners. And under that program, it's run by a third party. They go out and they put together financing, and they'll work with a homeowner. They will pay back that entity by an on-bill payment. So we put that on the bill. When the house is sold, generally today, I believe, they are zeroing out that loan. I believe it is a lien on the home, but they zero it out, I believe, when they sell the home right now.
Okay, follow up. Then was the part taken out then that notice must be maintained with the county clerk if payment obligation applies to subsequent property owners? What would that apply to if the loan is paid off at the time of purchase?
Chair Bailey, Representative Whitsitt. The program that's being done for the homeowners, that's the way it works there. In this case, we have not used this statute, and so we would be filing a set of tariffs with the Public Utility Commission that basically sets up the framework for how this program would be operated. The concept, I think, in the statute there is basically that if, say, it's a large commercial structure, and they made it, they could deal with that time of sale. They could pass it on. I mean, they could continue the program. They could continue to pay it back on the bill. So it gives that flexibility, so that it could continue to stay with the property, or it could be closed out at the time of sale.
How does a future property owner know that this is on? That they are essentially indebted for this. What part of the real estate transaction shows up, does this show up on, that says, here's the price of your property, and then here's the lien on the property? How do you make sure that people understand that?
Representative Bailey and Chair Bailey, Representative, what's it? Generally, through any kind of a lien or a title search, your liens would show up. So they would know that. Again, if it's a the concept as we looked at this is primarily larger entities, and so we would most likely know that they were selling the property, and so we probably could enter into a conversation with any new buyers or make sure that happens as well.
Representative Weiner.
Actually, probably not more energy environment, but the lien is paid off. I mean, when the purchase happens, all liens are usually paid off at that point. Probably for another committee, but I think everything that shows up on the title when you do that search, that money's transferred and then pay off everything at that time, I believe.
Chair Bailey, Representative Weiner, that's my understanding, at least on the residential real estate side. I can't speak to the others.
I don't have the kind of money to buy a big industrial, so...
Okay.
Chair Bailey might give me a loan someday.
Scrounge it up. Gentlemen, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Seeing no further questions. Does anybody else wish to testify on House Bill, or excuse me, Senate Bill 561? Seeing no one further, close the public hearing on Senate Bill 561. Open work session on Senate Bill 561. Simply say before the motion, I think this is an important small step forward. I have always believed that we ought to treat our energy efficiency infrastructure in a similar way to the way that we treat generation infrastructure, and that for utilities that choose to make investments that are in the best interest of their ratepayers and in their business model, that we ought to grant them that ability to make those investments in a way that works for their business model. And I think this is a small step towards that. I applaud Northwest Natural for its leadership and vision in bringing this forward. I think this is really at the cutting edge of what we've been looking at nationwide. And so small bill about a bigger thing, as a former representative used to say. Representative Widener.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I know the residential program has actually been a pretty good program that's been out there. I know people that have used it, and then it just goes right on their utility bills. So they basically, their bill will stay about the same, but everything that they save through the conservation basically breaks even. The McMinnville Utility Company has actually done that throughout the city, and it's been a very, very good program. So.
Okay. Motion.
Chair Bailey, I move Senate Bill 561A to the floor of the due pass recommendation.
Vice Chair Johnson moves Senate Bill 561A to the floor of the due pass recommendation. Discussion. Seeing no further discussion, clerk, please call the roll.
Representative Betts?
Aye.
Representative Dimbrough?
Aye.
Representative Reardon?
Aye.
Representative Vega Peterson?
Aye.
Representative Wagner?
Aye.
Representative Whitson?
No.
Vice Chair Johnson?
Aye.
Vice Chair Boone?
Aye.
Chair Bailey?
Aye. Motion carries. Nobody objects. I'd actually like to carry this bill.
I object, Chair.
Okay, I'll carry the bill. And close the work session on Senate Bill 561A. Any word on the paperwork? Okay, we're going to move to our informational hearing. So open an informational meeting on Hanford and invite up Ken Niles. Thank you for your patience, Mr. Niles.
Oh, yeah. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you for the invitation. We appreciate the opportunity to give you a detailed briefing on Hanford. It's been in the news a lot. A lot of stuff comes across the media about what's going on at Hanford. Sometimes it doesn't really give you the full picture of what actually is and has been happening there. So I appreciate this opportunity. I'm Ken Niles. I'm the administrator of the Nuclear Safety Division at the Oregon Department of Energy. Been with the agency for about 24 years now. All of that time has been spent working on Hanford. It's a certainly a topic that that goes on and on. We are often asked why Oregon's involved, since the Hanford site clearly is in Washington State. And just to orient folks, it's in southeastern Washington. It's just north of the Tri-Cities of Richland, Kennewick, and Pasco. It's a very large site. It's 560 square miles in area. And for us, really, the easiest part in looking at that map to recognize the interest in Oregon is that blue line that flows through the Hanford site and, of course, represents the Columbia River. And protecting the river, ensuring that the cleanup that is done today does not pose harm or threat to the Columbia River in the years, the decades, the centuries to come is why Oregon is involved so much. I mean, we all know the value of the Columbia River and its importance to recreation and agriculture and salmon fishery. It's, you know, obviously a treasure resource that that is unfortunately at risk from Hanford. We also are involved because of the transportation of radioactive materials. Hanford is just one of what was at one point over 100 sites around the nation that were involved in one aspect or other of nuclear weapons production and development. All of those sites beginning in the late 1980s, early 1990s went into a cleanup mode, and that has resulted in waste in some cases coming to Hanford, some cases leaving Hanford. We expect to see a lot more waste over the coming years leave Hanford. If you look at just the activity that we've had over the years since the state began a radioactive material transportation permit program in 1982, you can see that we do have a fairly significant amount of transportation and of radioactive materials. Most of that goes through the northeast part of the state, through Interstates 82 and 84 between Umatilla and Ontario. We also are involved and engaged in Hanford because of the potential threat to Northeast Oregon from an accident. This is a commercial nuclear power plant. It's not associated with Hanford other than it's located on the Hanford side. It's on leased land. It's a commercially owned facility that generates nuclear power. But that facility and some of the other facilities at Hanford that do pose other risks because of fire or explosion or some other incident, there is a 50-mile nuclear emergency planning zone for those facilities, and that planning zone does come into Northeast Oregon, parts of Morrow and Umatilla County. And not related to Hanford, but still in the nuclear vein, is the fact that the shutdown Trojan nuclear power plant, the irradiated nuclear fuel, is still located on that site, about 40 miles northwest of Portland. We're involved in oversight of the storage, the safe storage of those materials. Interestingly, Trojan has now appeared to jump near the top of the list in terms of facilities that may actually get rid of their spent nuclear fuel if the United States is successful at a federal level in developing an interim storage facility, which they're targeting now to begin operating in 2021. A lot has to happen before that will occur, but right now Trojan is among 10 facilities that are shut down around the United States, and the kind of the philosophy right now is to focus on those shutdown sites in terms of early shipments. In terms of Hanford, and I want to give you a little bit of brief history on the Hanford site. This is a picture that was taken in the early 1960s. That's the end reactor in the foreground, the K East and K West reactors in the kind of the middle part of the picture. You can see the steam coming off the water that has just gone through the reactors and is thermally become quite hot. That kind of zigzag trench is actually a liquid waste disposal facility in which they poured millions of gallons of contaminated liquids, and you can see it's very close proximity to the Columbia River. In terms of Oregon's role at Hanford, and I'll get into a little bit more of the background at Hanford in a minute, this photo in some respect very much represents the involvement, the interest we've had over the years. Sometimes that door has been open pretty wide, and we've been able to get in and be involved and participate in meetings and review documents. It's been open more so in recent years than it was in the early years, when that door was almost invariably shut pretty tightly. I think the U.S. Department of Energy, which is the federal agency that owns and operates Hanford, now does very much respect Oregon's involvement and interest at Hanford. They recognize that we are a player. We do have things to offer in terms of the cleanup and the decisions that are made there. But at the same time, we lack legal authority. We're not a regulator at Hanford. And so sometimes this is the forum we kind of take, and sometimes this is the position we have to take, that of the noisy neighbor, if you will. And again, a little less so than I think we've had to do in earlier years, when Oregon did have to yell rather loudly and clearly to try and get some attention. What we really do in terms of our oversight is a lot of it is technical review and policy review and comment. We receive mail documents, fortunately now on CD a lot more, but it's often weighed in the pounds and stacked in many inches, thousands of pages of documents that talk about all the cleanup proposals that are being made and the decisions that are being made. Early on in our involvement at Hanford, we recognized that again, when our influence was much less then, that there were opportunities for us to play a role that wasn't being played. And one of those we chose very early on was to involve and engage the public. The U.S. Department of Energy initially was very poor at communicating with the public, very technical documents, very difficult technical issues. We've worked to try and produce materials that are educational, that are informational, that are hopefully unbiased, that really lay out what the situation is at Hanford. We do have one aspect of legal authority at Hanford. Under CERCLA, we are a trustee of natural resources at Hanford. Obviously, with the releases that have occurred over the years at Hanford, there has been, and nobody disputes this, there has been significant environmental damage to the natural resources at Hanford. And it's a fairly convoluted and complex process to establish the amount of damage and what restoration might need to occur to restore those lost resources. We're working with the state of Washington, with three Native American tribes, and with the federal government in that process, which also will continue for many years to come. I mentioned briefly transportation safety is an issue for us because of all the shipments we see, the emergency preparedness. And hopefully through the years of the things that we've done, we've come to be known as, and I believe we have, as an honest broker on these issues. We hear often the U.S. Department of Energy is very willing to talk about the accomplishments they've had at Hanford, not so willing to talk about the challenges. We often find the citizen groups very willing to talk about those challenges, not maybe willing to talk as much about successes. And I'm going to give you a little bit of both, because we think both are very important parts of the story. So let me give you a little bit of basic background on Hanford. A lot of things have happened at Hanford, a lot of different things in terms of research and development, but really Hanford's primary mission, what it really did for more than 40 years, was produce plutonium for nuclear weapons. And it was the first plutonium production facilities built in the world, part of World War II, Manhattan Project, and they obviously were successful. Plutonium from Hanford was used in the bomb dropped on Nagasaki, Japan. It had major expansions at Hanford in the late 1940s, early and mid-1950s. If you kind of look at what happened at a world view in terms of the Cold War escalating, a lot of times you can see an action happening somewhere, and a reaction often was an expansion of production capability at Hanford, building new reactors, expanding the plutonium production capabilities, changing the processes that they did there. And overall, Hanford did produce plutonium for about 45 years, from the end of World War II right up until 1988. And in all, they made about 74 tons of plutonium, enough for tens of thousands of nuclear warheads. So the process to make plutonium is they take uranium fuel, which is shown there, and was manufactured in this part of the site, the 300 area, which is at the very southern part of the Hanford site. It was taken, and this is a picture of those facilities. Again, right on the Columbia River, these facilities are. They used a lot of water, and a lot of water was generated as waste. Those uranium fuel assemblies were loaded into cask cars and taken by rail up to the reactor facilities, and there were 9 of the reactors built at Hanford. Here is the face of one of those reactors, and a worker involved there in installing the new fuel into the reactor. And the reactors are all along the river as well. There are 9 of the reactors that were built throughout the years, beginning in 1944. The last was built in the early 1960s. After a period of weeks in the reactor in which the nuclear fission process occurs and there are different elements generated, including very small amounts of plutonium, the fuel, which you can see in baskets here, was pushed out of the back of the reactor, collected in pools, loaded into cask cars, heavily shielded cask cars, because by then the fuel was very highly radioactive, and it was hauled to the Canyon facilities, the processing facilities at Hanford. This is an example of one of those facilities, most of them about 1,000 feet in length, and it the fuel was taken into one end of those and was processed through the length of that with a lot of different chemical processes. Those facilities, five of the canyon facilities at Bolduc-Hanford, located in the center part of the site, which is called the Central Plateau. It is actually an elevation a couple of hundred feet higher than the river. When the fuel was first arrived in these processing facilities, it was dipped in a nitric acid bath to dissolve the fuel cladding, the outer part of the fuel that held it together, and then again went through a series of processes that culminated at this facility called the plutonium finishing plant, and this was the final product at Hanford, a plutonium puck, which was then shaped later on at a facility outside of metropolitan Denver called Rocky Flats and made into the shape that they inserted into nuclear weapons. So that's what they, among many other things at Hanford with research and some actual energy production, this was really Hanford's predominant mission through the years. And every step of the process that I mentioned to you generated waste. This is a desert. This is artificial lakes and ponds that were created because they had so much liquid waste generated. They estimated at one point in the 1990s about 440 billion gallons of contaminated liquids disposed to the soil at Hanford. Solid waste at Hanford, huge amounts, millions of cubic feet of waste, solid waste, that was like, you know, all other industries really, or most other industries in the 50s and 60s and early 70s, that just buried their waste. And you can see the results of some of that waste. The containers over the years lose their integrity. The waste mixes with the soil. Rainwater falls on the surface and flushes that those contaminants deeper into the soil and eventually into the groundwater. So plutonium production ended Hanford in 1988, the fall of the Berlin Wall, the end of the Cold War, and again, other facilities around the country involved in these efforts shut down about the same time. Department of Energy, under very heavy pressure from citizen groups, from the state of Oregon, from Native American tribes, and facing litigation from the state of Washington, did eventually agree to a cleanup plan and signed a cleanup agreement with the state of Washington and with U.S. Environmental Protection Agency. It's called the Tri-Party Agreement. And the goal of that was to reach compliance with environmental laws. And so it set out a series of schedules by which various aspects of the cleanup would be accomplished by certain dates. And when they signed this in 1989, they didn't know a lot of what those dates would be. A lot of them were to be determined. And a lot of what they anticipated have proven not to be correct. Everything at Hanford, really, in terms of the cleanup, virtually everything has been more difficult, more complex, has taken longer, has cost more money. In 1989, when they signed this cleanup agreement, they envisioned about a 30-year cleanup, which would run till 2019. They got it maybe half right, because the cleanup is going to continue easily into the 2050s, 2060s, maybe longer. So I want to take you back to 1989, the beginning of cleanup, and give you kind of a frame of reference for the extent of the waste and the different forms of waste that they had to deal with at Hanford. So I mentioned over 400 billion gallons of contaminated liquids disposed to the soil. There was one waste stream they knew even in the very beginning it was so toxic that they couldn't just dump it to the soil, and they built underground storage tanks. And when those tanks filled up over the years, they built more tanks and more tanks and more tanks. So when we got to 1989, we had about 60 million gallons of highly toxic radioactive waste in a variety of forms, in liquids and solids and semi-sludges, that were stored in 177 aging underground tanks. So they've aged a lot more since 1989. And part of the problem beginning in 1989 with the cleanup is they really couldn't focus so much on the cleanup because they had some very urgent safety issues. They had tanks that were generating hydrogen gases in some cases in concentrations that were very vulnerable to a spark or some ignition source causing an explosion or fire in one of these tanks. They had one tank that was generating such excessive heat it was self-boiling. What complicated the matter was they knew that tank was leaking, but they had to add water to the tank to keep the temperature somewhat down so it would not further damage the tank integrity. It took years to resolve these tank safety issues. The numbers at Hanford are just staggering. Hundreds of burial grounds. So the pictures I showed you earlier of those barrels and boxes going into the soil, hundreds of different sites around the Hanford site that were used to dispose of those, hundreds of liquid waste disposal sites. Again, here's a picture of one of those liquid waste trenches right by the river. And disposal of millions of gallons of contaminated liquids was still occurring in 1989. Many, many contaminated facilities, about 500, including the 9 production reactors and 5 of these huge chemical processing facilities. 80-plus square miles of groundwater contamination above regulatory standards. So all this liquid waste that they disposed to the soil in hopes that it would mostly bind to the soil didn't always occur. A lot of it flowed all the way to the groundwater, which in some cases a couple hundred feet below that central plateau. Extensive plumes of contaminants reaching the Columbia River, a mixture of different radioactive materials and different chemicals. These are some of the spent fuel rods that were not processed. So these were pulled out of the reactor, highly radioactive, for a variety of reasons, was not processed to remove the plutonium. These were stored underwater for several decades at one of the reactors just a quarter mile from the Columbia River. They identified very early on in the cleanup process a concern about the integrity of those just concrete basins and their ability to withstand even a moderate earthquake and maintain that water for cooling and protection of these materials, which are pyrophoric. If the water had drained and this fuel had come in contact with the atmosphere, they would have ignited and started a fire that would have been extremely difficult to extinguish. 18 tons of plutonium and plutonium-bearing materials. So throughout the processes of producing plutonium, you had plutonium and plutonium liquids and plutonium slurries and metals, that most of which were not conducive to safe long-term storage. So everything you've heard about Hanford usually is about all the bad. And there's a lot of bad, and I'm going to get into some of that in a few minutes. But I do want to talk to you about the progress, because there has been a lot of progress. It's been hard-fought, again, longer than any of us thought might take, but some very good cleanup progress. And I'll call your attention to the numbers at the bottom of most of these slides to tell you how long it took to accomplish some of these things. Again, keeping in mind the frame of reference, 1989 is when cleanup began. So it took them 8 years to stop the problem from getting worse in terms of those contaminated liquids being disposed of the soil. They had to build treatment facilities. They had to shut down some laboratories and things like that. Beginning then, at least that problem was not getting worse. It took 12 years to resolve those tank safety issues. And at Hanford, even though there are other facilities around the country that did some of the same things, there's facilities in Russia and England that did some of the same things, a lot of these problems at Hanford are truly unique and took some very creative solutions to resolve these issues. The 177 underground tanks, at the beginning of cleanup, they had labeled 67 of those as either known or suspected leakers. So one of the things that they felt they could do to at least, again, alleviate the problem from getting worse was to remove the free liquids, the pumpable liquids from those older tanks, the 149 single shell tanks, and pump that into 28 double shell tanks, the newer tanks that they had at Hanford. It took a court order by the state of Washington to get that to happen, and it took 15 years for that to happen. But that reduced the threat of those leaking tanks. We thought reduced it a little greater than what we're finding out today, and I'll talk about that as well. So the spent fuel that was stored in those basins, they repackaged it, they dried it, they moved it to an interim storage configuration away from the Columbia River. The safe storage configuration, we believe, is safe for many decades to come. And again, that took a lot of years, over $1.5 billion to accomplish that process. They stabilized the plutonium and actually shipped the plutonium off-site to kind of a sister site in South Carolina that did a lot of the same things Hanford did. And so a lot of that and a lot of the security requirements associated with protecting that plutonium went away as well when it was shipped off-site. They constructed a number of treatment facilities. The cleanup at Hanford is important to understand that you're not completely removing the risk. If you have contaminated radioactive soil, that the contaminants will be radioactive for 30 years or 300 years or 1,000 years, you can't do anything about that radioactive constituency in terms of its radioactivity. It will still be radioactive for however long that particular isotope would be radioactive. But if it's in free soil along the river, you can dig it up, you can move it away from the river, you can move it out of the free environment. And what they've done is move those contaminated soil and the contaminated building debris into this large engineered environmental disposal facility located in the center of the site. It has a leachate collection system, so any water, any liquids, any contaminants that flow through this will be collected and treated. And eventually, when this is completed and covered, there will be an engineered cap over it, which will hopefully reduce the water infiltration into this facility. Of the 9 reactors they have cocooned, the term they've used, 6 of these, they've torn down all the support buildings around each of these 6 reactors, dug up the waste sites, put on a new roof, and basically will allow the very radioactively hot reactor within the core of that to decay. The plan is in 75 years, and who knows what will happen in 75 years, but the plan is to allow that radioactivity to decay over those 75 years, and then at some point the levels would be low enough then to allow workers to dismantle those reactors and to haul them off the shoreline of the Columbia River. They've demolished dozens of contaminated buildings. There's, you know, some of these are very heavily contaminated, some very lightly contaminated. So there's a lot of different things involved with those. They've dug up millions of tons of contaminated soil from along the Columbia River. All those liquid waste disposal sites, they've gone in, they've taken out the top 10 or 15 or 20 feet, depending on the circumstances at each, removed it from that free environment near the river, and backfilled with clean soil, and cleaned up dozens of burial grounds. The records at Hanford, you know, if you think back to 1944 and all the production urgency that they had initially with World War II and later with the Cold War, some of those records, not so great. And as they've gone into some of these burial grounds, they've found contaminated railroad cars filled with carcasses of contaminated animal remains that were used in experiments. They found a safe that had some plutonium vials inside. They found contaminated vehicles that were buried. They found what's been a lot dicier to deal with, uranium shavings, which are also pyrophoric, and they were packed in liquids, which often had leaked out over the years, and when they removed those and got those into the environment, they would ignite, and they quickly learned to have a hopper of sand above those to dump as soon as the ignition occurred. So some very difficult things with those burial grounds, and still some tough ones to go. So here's the site map again. The gray area was declared the Hanford Reach National Monument during President Clinton's years. There was very little contamination in those areas. It was mostly a safety and buffer zone for security and safety. There's some Army motor pools and anti-aircraft facilities and some light contamination. That's all been cleaned up. Eventually, the hope is to open up the National Monument for much freer recreational use than has been allowed because of the safety that still needs to occur with the facility. The green area is called the River Corridor. Most of the cleanup that's occurred at Hanford since the early days has focused on that river corridor. It was a message that Oregon and the Native American tribes and the activist groups and many others said, focus that cleanup, begin near the river and protect the river. The Department of Energy had a plan to complete cleanup along the river, at least surface cleanup. The pumping of the contaminated groundwater is going to take decades. Their plan to complete cleanup along the river corridor by 2015. For the most part, they're going to make that. There's a couple of reactor areas and a couple of burial grounds that are going to probably take into the early 2020s to complete. By then, that entire green area, the surface, will be cleaned up. Center of the site is that smaller kind of yellow area will be a waste management area forever. So let me focus a little bit on remaining challenges, and it really begins with the tank waste. There are 56 million gallons of highly radioactive waste stored in these 177 tanks. And if you remember when I talked about the beginning of cleanup, there was about 60 million. Fortunately, it's not that they've lost 4 million gallons extra, although they estimate that they've lost about 1 million gallons of waste into the soil from these tanks. But they have an evaporator. They're able to concentrate the liquids down to some extent. And through use of that evaporator, they've been able to reduce the volume. Really can't get much further below that through use of the evaporator. The tanks are very old. And I'll get into that in a moment. 67 is the number that we have been living with for about 20 years until late last year when the number went up. First, a double shell tank was discovered to be leaking from its inner shell in October of last year. And this is a really big deal because the waste is going to remain in these tanks for many decades before treatment can occur. Those 28 double shell tanks are what the U.S. Department of Energy was counting on to really contain safely this waste for a long, long time to come. And the fact that one of these has failed, it's not leaking into the environment. So far, it's just leaking from the inner shell. It means we've lost one of 28 tanks. It calls into question really the integrity of those other 27 tanks in terms of being able to use those tanks for many decades to come. The single shell tanks, early this year, Energy Secretary Chu announced to Governor Inslee of Washington that one of the tanks, one of the single shell tanks, was actively leaking. And then a week later, in a meeting again between Secretary Chu and Governor Inslee, the U.S. Department of Energy at Hanford was not ready to declare officially that six tanks are leaking. But in the Secretary's estimation to the Governor, he relayed that actually six single shell tanks are actively leaking at Hanford. While the easily pumpable liquids were removed from all those tanks, there still was a lot of liquid caught up in the spaces within the solid waste. And so there is still waste, millions of gallons available to potentially leak. The leaks are small at this point. It's still in the few thousands of gallons combined for those six tanks per year. But we don't know that will be the case next week, next year, a decade from now. And we know that the leaked tank waste has reached groundwater underneath every one of the single shell tank farms. So these are very old tanks. Go back to World War II, almost 70 years now. Very caustic, highly radioactive, thermally hot waste in carbon steel tanks lined a single shell of carbon steel and concrete. Tanks that initially were designed to have an estimated 20-year design life. The double shell tanks, the newest of these tanks, is still 27 years old. So time is not on our side. The Department of Energy does have a plan to deal with this waste. They want to immobilize the waste through a process called vitrification, where they mix the waste with glass-making materials under heat to form a molten glass. It would then be stored or poured into stainless steel canisters where it would harden. It would still be radioactive. Again, you can't change that property, but it would no longer be, again, in the free environment. It would be much easier to manage. The intent is to use vitrification, which is a proven technology, It's being used currently at Savannah River in South Carolina. It's been used at a site in New York. It's being used in Europe. Unfortunately, we don't have operating vitrification facilities at Hanford. They've been working to build these facilities, and it's kind of hard to envision a construction project that began 11 years ago and is still a long ways from completion. You can see the progress that they made over the years of building a complex of very large, complicated facilities, collectively called the waste treatment plant at Hanford. Unfortunately,
Mr. Jones, I just want to pause you for a second.
Yes.
On that slide, if you could go back. The scale of those buildings is incredible. I think it's hard to tell in this slide, but when you look at the tiny dots there that are construction trucks next to these buildings, those are enormous structures.
These are enormous structures. The large facility in the upper left-hand corner that this looks visually the farthest from completion and is called the pretreatment facility, and has a footprint of about 4 football fields. Just to give you an example of the size. So these are incredibly huge facilities. And you can see around that facility, two of those pedestal cranes that we've seen at large construction sites. It gives you a bit of scale as well.
Bigger than a Costco.
So over the years, since construction began in 2002, the cost has escalated from a little over $4 billion to $12 billion. The hot start, which was actually initially 2009, was pushed to 2011, is now 2019. The plan to be fully operational in 2022, and the treatment is scheduled to take 25 years. I can tell you with certainty the cost will be more than $12 billion, by many billions. The hot start of December 2019 is very much in jeopardy. There are still very severe technical issues in terms of whether or not some of these facilities will work as designed. So even though the construction is 11 years along, all of the design issues are not yet resolved. And as far as how long it may take to eventually treat this, 25 years seems pretty optimistic. So if you think, again, the age of those tanks holding the waste, even the newest, 28 years old, by 2047 is still, you know, in its 60, and some of those tanks are over 100 years. So that's the biggest issue. Funding is an issue, as not surprising. The cleanup at Hanford is tremendously expensive. Hanford receives on average about $2 billion a year. Since cleanup began in 1989, they've received about $38 billion. There's a document that they've been putting out over the last few years called the Hanford Life Cycle Scope Schedule Report, which lays out what is proving to be a highly optimistic cleanup schedule and plan that would continue cleanup until about 2070 at a cost of $119 billion to go. So funding's a big issue, as we all understand, you know, the national funding challenges. $2 billion is a lot of money to send to a remote part of the United States for a cleanup project that has certainly had its challenges and problems, and Congress is very much aware of what those have been. So funding will be an ongoing problem. There is an issue that, just in terms of laying out a little bit the disagreements that sometimes occur between Oregon, along with many other stakeholders in the U.S. Department of Energy, of how much waste to leave in the soil. There are some sites at Hanford, some of the burial grounds, some of the liquid waste disposal sites that we know have heavy amounts of long-lived, highly mobile contaminants that the Department of Energy, predominantly for cost reasons, would like to leave it exactly where it is and just cover it up with a cap to prevent water intrusion. A lot of those issues have not yet come to the formal decision-making process, but the early indications we get from the Department of Energy are not very promising to us in terms of what some of those long-term plans are. groundwater contamination is a tremendously complex and expensive process. Again, to give you an idea of the contaminant plumes at Hanford, and yes, those do intersect the Columbia River. There are small amounts of contaminants entering the Columbia River today. A lot less than what we saw during the operational years in the 1950s and 1960s. And they're quickly diluted by the flow of the river. What they have done at Hanford to try and control and contain and clean up these plumes, for the most part, is they've installed pump and treat systems where they drill wells into the aquifer, they pump the water up, they run it through a treatment process, remove some of the contaminants. Some of the contaminants are tremendously difficult to remove because they bond with water so easily. And then they re-inject the cleaned water back to force the water plumes to those extraction wells. They've been pretty successful at reducing the flow of contaminants into the river. They've kind of reached a stage pretty well of containment. They're not yet at the stage of cleanup. They did just in the last year or so open a huge new pump and treat facility that was paid for with American Recovery and Reinvestment Act funds. Hanford, in addition to its $2 billion annual budget, received an extra $2 billion of ARRA funding. That groundwater treatment facility will do a lot towards actual cleanup of the groundwater, but it's at the very least, a multi-decade process to try and clean up these plumes. When I mentioned earlier, the documents that we receive in the mail are often measured in pounds and feet. This is one document. This is the final tank closure and waste management environmental impact statement that was released late last year. And I just want to highlight some of the facts in this related to groundwater. So what it does is it talks about and anticipates and calculates how contaminants at Hanford will spread over the centuries to come. And what it does show is that given the anticipated cleanup levels that we're looking at today, it shows a recontamination of the groundwater for centuries to come. So here's an example of a chemical called carbon tetrachloride, which was used very heavily at one facility and was very much a part of the liquid waste disposal from that facility, and you can see easily the site where that is. And the anticipated movement and spread of those contaminants in the next 120 years. You can see the greens, the yellows, the reds are above regulatory standards. So just to back you up, to show you the movement towards the river, and then even much further into the future. So in anticipation, this is just one of the contaminants. Visually, it's the most dramatic. I will admit that, because that's what I want to show you. But even looking at some of these other ones that are less visual, to see the recontamination that is expected to occur hundreds of years into the future with some of these. And with that, that's kind of the look at Hanford.
Mr. Niles, thank you for the presentation. I think it's almost difficult to formulate questions because I'm having trouble picking my jaw up a little bit after a presentation like that. It's extremely sobering, and I would mention to the committee members that for those of you, there are occasionally opportunities to go see the site. I've had a chance to go myself, and it is remarkable, the scope of the operation that is happening out there and the number of people that are working on it. So with that frame of comment, I'd throw it open. Representative Whitsitt.
I have several. I'll just kind of start. Do you use salt at all? In the southeast, they use salt diapirs. It's called to inject radioactive material into them because they're a natural geologic feature that you can... They're essentially sealed off and they can be salted. It moves. The salt acts like a liquid, essentially. And I just wondered if there's any consideration of sending some of this down to Louisiana into some of these vaults of salt diapirs, essentially.
Chair Bailey, Representative Whitsitt, there is a operating geologic disposal site in New Mexico that is in bedded salt formation half a mile below the surface outside Carlsbad. And under our federal law for disposal of radioactive waste, it has been designated to take one form of radioactive materials called transuranic waste, which is predominantly clothing, protective clothing, building debris contaminated with very small amounts of plutonium. And because plutonium is around virtually forever, it does need to be isolated from the environment. So that is a facility that began operating in 1999. Hanford has sent about 600 shipments of waste to that facility. They're not currently shipping, as the U.S. Department of Energy is focusing on other sites, but eventually Hanford will be the predominant supplier of waste of that type to that facility.
Okay. Please follow up. I was wondering on your groundwater that's being compromised, is it primarily going into basalts so that you have transmissivity across or through faults primarily versus porosity that you would have in other, I don't know what your geologic formation is up there, but that moves it a little faster if it goes along fault lines, the water, and versus pore-to-pore transmissivity. Do you know what?
Chair Bailey, Representative Whitsitt, the underground surface in Hanford is tremendously complex.
Yeah.
There are preferential pathways of flow. Oregon has, part of my staff is a hydrogeologist who would salivate over the opportunity to answer that question in detail. But through the years, you know, that's one of the things that Oregon has pushed very hard, is that the complexity of the groundwater at Hanford is such that I'd mentioned earlier the constructing of surface caps to remove water infiltration. That may not be effective if you have a preferential pathway and lateral flow, that you would get moisture falling here that flows underneath the cap and then can move that contaminants away from that. Recently, the U.S. Department of Energy chased a plume of chromium near the Columbia River that they went 80 feet deep all the way to groundwater. And the head of the Hanford Office of the Environmental Protection Agency said, if we had chased that plume in the direction we thought it had flowed, we would have completely missed it because just of the complexity of the underground surface. So very definitely there are preferential flows, and it's very difficult to assume which way things will go.
Thank you.
I know there are a few more questions. Mr. Nelson, would you stay up here, please? I want to pause for a minute and do the business on the other bill that we have before us very quickly, because there are a number of folks in the audience that I think are looking to move on. So I'm going to temporarily close the informational hearing on Hanford Nuclear Cleanup, open a work session on Senate Bill 692. Colleagues, you'll recall this bill went to the floor. It's now back like a bad penny. And we have an amendment that deals with an inconsistency between the Oregon bill, our bill, obviously, as it relates to large TVs and the California law that we are trying to remain consistent with. So that is the amendment that you have before you. It is the -8, -B8 amendments.
Okay. Mr. Johnson?
Mr. Chair, I move to adopt the -B8 amendments dated May 15th of 2013.
Vice Chair Johnson moves to adopt the -B8 amendments dated May 15th, 2013. Is there discussion of the B8s?
Mr. Chair, could you or could someone detail exactly what this does and how it may impact some of those who were either on one side or the other of the issue prior to the amendment?
Chair Bailey, Representative Johnson, the -B8 amendment, the primary and really only change to be found there can be found on page 1, line 12, as well as page 10, line 26. Basically, it adds a exemption to TVs that have a viewable screen area of greater than or equal to 1,400 square inches, roughly a 37 by 37 inch TV. Anything greater than that increases the television stand by passive mode wattage rate from 1 watt to 3 watts, so triples that, and has no maximum power wattage requirement when the TV is actually on. Also, there is no minimum power factor. So this brings it completely into alignment with the California regulations.
I called Jim Craven and chat about this.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Jim Craven on behalf of Tech America. We cross over some of the large TV manufacturers are also members of our national organization, so brought this to our attention. I think your staff has done a good job. There was a little confusion in drafting the amendment. California had an existing standard of 3 watts for all TVs. When they did the new standards, they adopted standards for TVs less than 1,400 square inches. So what you see in the bill, the 3 watts is nothing new for the very large TVs. That's been a standard forever. There are new standards in California for the smaller TVs, and this amendment trues those two things up. So along the realm of if we're going to adopt California rules, we ought to adopt them directly as we did with the battery recharger part of this bill. This is in the same line. So that's really what it does, and we appreciate the chance to get this in at the last minute.
And Mr. Craven, my understanding is that you are supportive of this bill and that the Consumer Electronics Association is at least neutral on the bill at this point.
Yes, we've supported the bill since the Senate side, and we still support it. That's my understanding. I never want to speak for someone else, but that's my understanding is that CEA is neutral on ultimate passage.
Representative Whitener.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Jim, just real quick on the chargers, because that's one piece that gives me angst, along with other things. But I'm just wondering what California or what they're doing there, because I know, like, for us to go through and redo all of our chargers, we're looking, it cost roughly about probably $3 million. And is what we will end up doing is referring people to purchase them from companies outside of the state. So when they call us up and need a replacement charger, we'll say buy it from Reliability Direct, who's located in Texas, and rather than that, those dollars come to Oregon, it's going to go to Texas, and we'll drop ship to the customer. Are you seeing much of that happen in California? Is this when you guys have talked? Have you talked about this issue at all? Because for a company to go back and retroactively redesign all of their equipment, it becomes very expensive. It's easy to do it going forward, and I'm wondering why you guys basically thought it was okay to let the retroactive nature of this take place. So where your members are on that.
Right. Mr. Chair, Representative Whitener, and I heard your concerns at the previous hearing when we discussed this bill a week or so ago. I'm not terribly qualified to answer all those intricacies. I just will say that up front. I think most of this is manufactured on or after. Most of the provisions, there's certifiably smart people behind me here that might be able to address that a little bit better.
I'm getting head shakes that there are no certifiably smart people behind you.
So. Oh, they're all missing. There are advocates for the bill behind me. I can't thoroughly answer that, Representative Whitener. I'm sorry. The details of all the timing on which chargers have to be. I mean, I was asked to make sure that since California's a done deal, to make sure if we're going to do that here, that it's the same. Because we don't, in the products that we make in the IT world, we don't make an Oregon charger versus a California charger. We're already kind of on the hook in California, and if we're going to do it here, we'd like it to be the same.
Yeah.
Let me follow up.
Quick follow-up.
I guess the thing is, I mean, going forward, it's easy to put it in your design. It's all of your stuff that you've already designed, the retroactive nature of that, of the products that you still sell. And that's the thing that's kind of surprised me, where Tech America has kind of gotten behind this bill. Or maybe it's just the larger manufacturers or some of your smaller ones are the acceptance. Because this could be a bill where it's maybe the big guys say, hey, let's do this to push the little guy out.
Mr. Chair, Representative Whitener, it's probably not quite accurate to say we're behind this bill. We are accepting of the reality of California imposing these standards and truing up to them rather than this being our initiative. There are some provisions, I think, in the final section or second to last section of the bill that talk about spare parts and being able to supply those for a period of time. And I think that's what that's intended to do, is to say if you're replacing something that's already out in the market, there is a certain window there. So we might want to look at that section, see if that helps you at all in your own business.
Okay. It doesn't, so I've went through it pretty thorough. So.
Okay. All right, seeing no further questions, thank you.
Thank you.
Motion. Mr. Chair, I'm going to make a motion.
Mr. Chair, I move to adopt the, we did that, the amendment.
Oh, sorry, we are still in. We haven't voted on the amendments yet.
No,
sorry.
We're still amendments.
We are under the motion to adopt the amendments. Excuse me. Is there any objection to the amendments? Seeing no objection to the amendments, B8s are adopted. Mr. Johnson?
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 692B is amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Vice Chair Johnson moves Senate Bill 692B to the floor with a due pass recommendation as amended. Discussion? Representative Benz?
No, thank you, Mr. Chair. I was a no before, I'll be a no again, but I want to make it clear that I understand the value of these standards, and I understand the necessity of following what California does. As goes California, so goes pretty much every other place. But in my opinion, and I did a bunch of research on this morning, the better approach is the national approach. I know the bill to try to move these things along has been stalled in Congress for a while. Nonetheless, the type of problems one encounters when we do it state by state as opposed to nationally is reflected in the kind of conversation we just heard. So be known.
Thank you. And your point on national standards is well taken. Sometimes multiple state action can help goose things along at the federal level. Representative Widener.
Yeah, I'll be a no. Still, due to the retroactive nature of this, it would be like saying to car manufacturer, you know, your car must have 40 miles to the gallon, and you can't sell any cars here if they didn't exceed that. So the used cars market, every place else would not be allowed to sell those cars, and that's kind of what we're doing with this bill. So for that reason, I will be a no vote on this.
Okay. Seeing no further discussion, clerk, please call the roll.
Representative Dembro. Yes. Representative Erdman. Yes. Representative Akiterson. Aye. Representative Weider. No. Representative Whitsitt. No. Vice Chair Johnson. Yes. Vice Chair Coon. Aye. Chair Bailey. Aye. Motion carries. And Representative Dembro, would you be willing to carry again? Yes, sir. All right. Representative Dembro will carry. Mr. Chair, I would like to serve notice of issuing a minority report on this.
Do we have the amendments, Representative?
So we do not have amendments for it.
Close the work session on Senate Bill 692. And Mr. Niles, please continue. Any questions for Mr. Niles on the previous subject? Representative Boone.
I do. And thank you for coming. It's kind of reminded me of about 8 years ago when Dr. Chris Goldfinger came and told us about the Cascadia event and what it was going to be like. We were all slumped in our seats at the end of the presentation. But it just, one thing I wanted to ask you is, you can answer it later, but I just wanted to comment on it. All the numbers that you gave us, the costs of production, cleanup, and everything that's being done now is around cleanup, it sounds like. Just kind of begs the question of what could be done with that money. And how many wave energy projects we could have developed with that. But my question to you is it safe there now? I have to go to Richland for a conference.
Chair Bailey, Representative Boone, yes, it is safe. The contaminants are well isolated. There's a good understanding of where the contaminated areas are, and there are fairly strict regulatory controls over off-site or public exposure.
But I shouldn't drink the water. I'm getting your baptism.
The water is safe to drink.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Benz?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And years ago, back in the late 80s when I was on the Water Resource Commission, we had this presentation. And so after all these years, I'm happy to see that progress is being made. My question has to do with yesterday's presentation in our Committee on Economic Development and Transportation, where we heard about the Cascadia earthquake possibility, and you kind of alluded to it in your presentation. So if that were to happen, how prepared is that site for that event?
Chair Bailey, Representative Benz. Difficult to quantify. If we had a Cascadia event, I think there certainly would be damages in Hanford that would be severe. We have all those old tanks that there would be a threat of a dome collapse, which could then open an avenue into the environment. There are about a third of the radioactivity at the site is stored in, was removed from the tank waste many years ago. It's radioactive cesium and strontium and put in capsules. It's stored underwater in a basin, and there may be issues about whether or not that basin could withstand a Cascadia earthquake. The threat, I would say, is less than it was 20 years ago, that they have reduced the risk considerably, but there's still a long ways to go.
Thank you.
Additional questions, Representative Reardon?
One of the things that makes me wonder, well, thank you, by the way, for coming in. This is a, although I'm almost sorry I asked for the presentation, because now I'm kind of depressed, but I am thankful for the work that's being done and that we're making progress. But one of the things I wonder about, you know, we're doing these millions and billions of dollars of projects. How do you know that we're getting a good return on investment? Is there a way to, I mean, it just looks like we're just dumping whatever amount of money is available. Is there any kind of incentive for good performance on these types of contracts, or do they just keep doing?
Chair Bailey, Representative Reardon, that has been one of the bigger and more frequent criticisms of the Hanford cleanup. The Department of Energy's Inspector General has at times, and the Congressional Oversight Offices have chastised the U.S. Department of Energy for not better controlling the work of the contractors. I would say that, well, one thing is we don't have the staff or the capability of really monitoring that in any detail. It is such a huge, huge process. I would say that I believe there have been improvements over the years, but I think a lot of us still do have concerns about the way in which some of these contracts are, the way in which they're structured, that sometimes does seem to pay for even for lack of performance.
One follow-up,
please.
And just follow up a little bit. What amount of money is the state of Oregon on the hook for in regards to the Hanford situation?
Chair Bailey, Representative Reardon,
how much of this issue hits Oregon taxpayers?
Well, as the funding is all from federal tax dollars,
okay.
So whatever share that Oregon would provide would be, you know, but there's nothing specifically that targets Oregon in any way or any bill. It's just all federal taxpayer money that goes towards the cleanup.
Okay, good to hear. Thank you.
Representative Benz?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And there's been a series of assertions. We've heard articles. You kind of, once again, referenced it in your presentation about not having the technical know-how to actually fix the problem, and that the buildings being constructed are being built in anticipation of scientific work that has yet to occur, and that I think you pointed out that 2019 was the date that we'd actually start managing this problem, and yet that's being pushed back. Is that because it's kind of like this cellulosic ethanol? We hope to someday have it, but we don't have the technology yet. We haven't figured out how to do it. So my question to you is, are we still waiting for technology to catch up with the need?
Representative Bailey, Chair Bailey, Representative Benz, I would not say we're waiting on technology. I would say that the process is there are some very difficult technical challenges because of the variety of waste at Hanford, because the other successful vitrification facilities that have been built and operated have basically all dealt with one type of waste. And at Hanford, virtually every one of those 177 tanks has a different type of waste. Somehow it's chemically or radioactively different, which is makes this whole process much more complex. The issues that they're dealing with are design and technical and mechanical issues that I believe there can be a solution that we don't have to wait on the technology. But they did get a little bit in front of themselves in terms of the process they used was called a design build, where they were designing and building at the same time. And the building got too close to the design part of it. And they've had to slow that in two of the facilities while they resolve some of these very difficult technical issues. I would say that in the last year or two, we have seen an acknowledgement by the U.S. Department of Energy that indeed these are very tough questions that need a dedicated focus to resolve. And in the meantime, they should stop some of the work on building these facilities until they do resolve those. But the issues are they're erosion, corrosion type issues in one case, issues of mixing. So they're kind of mechanical issues that they do need to work through.
Thank you.
It's fascinating. I'm struck that in many ways it sort of mirrors the process of the Manhattan Project and building some of those initial facilities in the first place, right, in which I believe there were stories of blueprints being delivered to contractors on the day of, and they weren't even sure what they were building, but they were sort of figuring it out as they went. And perhaps cleanup isn't quite as sexy as building something new for the first time, but it in no way, I think, diminishes the truly heroic efforts that are going on and trying to figure out how to deal with these incredibly complex problems on an evolving basis, and to be able to address fundamental challenges that I don't think we have ever had to deal with fundamentally before.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would agree.
Representative Whitsitt.
So you're dealing with strontium, rubidium, cesium, U-32, 235, 238, I assume, and plutonium then, outside of that. And the half-life on something like strontium rubidium is in the hundreds of thousands to millions of years.
Chair Bailey, Representative Whitsitt, it virtually they're dealing with virtually any, you know, the whole bandwidth of radioactive materials and chemicals. Some of the biggest problems they have along the river right now and concern about the river contamination is with chromium, which was used in all the reactors to help purify the water, and is known to be toxic to salmon, and there's salmon spawning ground in the areas. When you look at that huge document that we showed you a picture of, the Tank Closure Waste Management EIS, you know, it does focus on those long-term risks from the radioisotopes that would be around for a very long time, such as iodine-129, such as neptunium, such as technetium, mobile and long-lived constituents like that, as well as things like uranium, that will be around for a very, very long time. Yes?
Further discussion?
Yeah. Just one question. Yeah. Thank you. Regarding oversight, I believe there's a Citizens Advisory Committee that meets and works with the cleanup operation. I have a couple of former colleagues who've been involved in that. Could you say something about that?
Certainly. Chair Bailey and Representative Dembroff. There are two, actually, advisory boards. There's an Oregon-specific board called the Oregon Hanford Cleanup Board, which Representative Bailey is one of six legislative members, and we have 10 citizen members and a total of 20 people. That board meets about three times a year, typically on the Columbia River, and it gives a good forum for U.S. Department of Energy and its regulators to come and talk with us. There is a broader regional board called the Hanford Advisory Board that has 32 members, of which I represent the Oregon Department of Energy, and then we have a representative from our cleanup board, and we have public at large members from Oregon as well, which meets more frequently, usually in Hanford, and deals really in a greater technical depth on some of these issues. But there are many opportunities for the public and others to weigh in.
Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Niles, I want to thank you for making the time to come and for all your work with the Department of Energy. I know it can sometimes be frustrating when the door isn't completely open to full involvement, but your expertise is valued and appreciated, and I'm really glad that Oregon does have a voice in the process and that you're leading up that charge. So thank you for coming and briefing us on this important issue.
Thank you very much. Thank you all.
Mr. Chair, I have a really important question I forgot to ask. Is that your dog?
Not my dog.
It's a cute dog.
Close the informational session on Hanford cleanup. Colleagues, this is it. We have no more business before the committee, to my knowledge, at this time. It's been real. What?
What happened to our Senate bills?
We're done.
We've seen them.
We've seen them.
Yeah.
We're done with Senate bills. So the really the last business before the committee at this point,
and this is an important
Really important, and that is our committee party.
Okay.
We will be appointing a task force. So it'll be bipartisan. Has to go to Ways and Means first.
Got a fiscal.
Vice Chair Johnson, you want to give us maybe a preview of some possibilities?
Some of us have been involved in some other environmental, i.e. scientific issues this session, particularly dealing with microbes. And there is one particular purveyor of microbes locally called Santiam Brewery that has offered to host at least make their facilities available to us on the date was the Tuesday.
We're looking at the Tuesday, first Tuesday of June.
Yeah, I think it's June 4th, perhaps, whatever that first Tuesday is in June. So what we would plan to be a time, let's say we could start early, 5? Earlier, whatever.
Look for details
the timing,
in your inbox.
So they would have some samples for us. I just talked with Ian, one of the owners, and he would like to give us tastings of his new bipartisan ale that he just has. crafted
nicely
in honor. It is in honor of the microbe.
Right.
And they will have one of their fire roasted or baked pizza purveyors there as well. So it could be a fun time. So stay tuned for details.
Stay tuned for more details. Although, colleagues, I will say that we do technically meet at, although we don't have any more meetings planned, we do technically meet at the call of the chair, just in case anything else comes up, additional informational hearings where we might want to get information on something, surprise bills that may end up here, although I can't imagine where those might come from, given that committees are shutting down. So I don't expect to meet again, but just be ready in this time slot in case we need to meet again. And with that, thank you all very much. Committee is adjourned.
Wow.
See you.